they wouldn't have become tormentors. It sounded so simple, so clean. But what had the humans known of Mazarthim power, besides how it could be used to punish and oppress, terrify and control? How could they even have imagined a sparrow or a feral, when all they knew was the likes of Scathis and Izagol? Could one reach back in time and expect them to be as merciful as it was possible to be 15 years later, with a mind and body unviolated by gods? Sarai's own empathy made her queasy. She'd said she could never forgive, but it would seem she already had, and she flushed with confused dismay. It was one thing not to hate, and another to forgive. She told Laszlo,
"I feel a little like him sometimes. The love and hate side by side. It's not easy having a paradox at the core of one's own being."
"What do you mean? What paradox? Being human and Godspawn?" Laszlo couldn't bring himself to call her Spawn, even if she called herself that. "Human and Mazarthim."
"There's that too. But no. I mean the curse of knowledge. It was easy when we were the only victims."
"We." She'd been looking down at their hands, still joined, hers curled inside his. But she glanced up now, and didn't retreat from the pronoun.
"There are 5 of us," she admitted. "And for the others there is only one truth, the carnage. But because of my gift, or curse, I've learned what it's been like for the humans, before and since. I know the insides of their minds, why they did it, and how it changed them. And so when I see a memory of those babies being..."
Her words choked off in a sob.
"And I know that was my fate too. I feel the same simple rage I always have. But now there's outrage too. On behalf of those young men and women who were plucked from their homes to serve the gods' purpose. And desolation for what it did to them. And guilt for what I've done to them."
She wept. And Laszlo drew her into an embrace, as though it were the most natural thing in the world that he should draw a mournful goddess against his shoulder, enfold her in his arms, breathe the scent of the flowers in her hair, and even lightly stroke her temple with the edge of his thumb. And though there was a layer of his mind that knew this was a dream, it was momentarily shuffled under by other, more compelling layers, and he experienced the moment as though it were absolutely real. All the emotion, all the sensation, the texture of her skin, the scent of her hair, the heat of her breath through his linen shirt, and even the moisture of tears seeping through it. But far more intense was the utter, ineffable tenderness he felt, and the solemnity, as though he had been entrusted with something infinitely precious, as though he had taken an oath, and his very life stood surety to it. He would recognize this later as the moment his center of gravity shifted, from being one of one, a pillar alone, a part, to being half of something that would fall if either side were cut away. 3 fears had gnawed at Laszlo back in his old life. The first, that he would never see proof of magic. The second, that he would never find out what had happened in Weep. Those fears were gone. Proof and answers were unfolding minute by minute. And the third, that he would always be alone. He didn't grasp it yet, at least not consciously, but he no longer was. And he had a whole new set of fears to discover. The ones that come with cherishing someone you're very likely to lose. Sarai. Sarai. Her name was calligraphy and honey.
"What do you mean?"
he asked her gently.
"What is it you've done to them?"
And Sarai, remaining just as she was, tucked into his shoulder, her forehead resting against his jaw, told him. She told him what she was and what she did, And even, though her voice went thin as paper, how she did it, moths and all. And when she was finished telling, and was tense in the circle of his arms, she waited to see what he would say. Unlike him, she couldn't forget that this was a dream. She was outside it and inside it at once. And though she didn't dare look at him while she told him her truth, her moth watched his sleeping face for any flicker of expression that might betray disgust. There were none. Laszlo wasn't thinking about the moths, though he did recollect now the one that had fallen dead from his brow on his first morning waking up in Weep. What really seized him was the implication of nightmares. It explained so much. It had seemed to him as though fear were a living thing here, because it was. Sarai kept it alive. She tended it like a fire and made sure it never went out. If there were such a goddess in a book of olden tales, she would be the villain, tormenting the innocent from her high castle. The people of Weep were innocent, most of them, and she did torment them. But what choice did she have? She had inherited a story that was strewn with corpses and clotted with enmity, and was only trying to stay alive in it. Laszlo felt many things for her in that moment, feeling her tension as he held her, and none of them were disgust. He was under her spell and on her side. When it came to Sarai, even nightmares seemed like magic. "The Muse of Nightmares," he said. "It sounds like a poem." "A poem?" Sarai detected nothing mocking in his voice, but she had to see his face to confirm it, which meant sitting up and breaking the embrace. Regretfully, she did. She saw no mockery, but only witchlight. Still witchlight, and she wanted to live in it forever. She asked in a hesitant whisper, "Do you still think I'm a singularly unhorrible demon?" "No," he said, smiling. "I think you're a fairy tale. I think you're magical and brave and exquisite. And," his voice grew bashful, only in a dream could he be so bold and speak such words, "I hope you'll let me be in your story." Chapter 44. An Extraordinary Suggestion. A poem? A fairy tale? Was that really how he saw her? Flustered, Sarai rose and went to the window. It wasn't just her belly now that felt a flutter like wild, soft wings, but her chest where her hearts were, and even her head. "Yes," she wanted to say with shy delight. "Please be in my story." But she didn't. She looked out into the night, up at the citadel in the sky, and asked, "Will there be a story? How can there be?" Laszlo joined her at the window. "We'll find a way. I'll talk to Errol Fane tomorrow. Whatever he did then, he must want to atone for it. I can't believe he means to hurt you. After all, he didn't tell anyone what happened. You didn't see how he was after. How he was..." "Broken?" supplied Sarai. "I did see him after. I'm looking at him right now. He's on the floor of Azarine's sitting room." "Oh," said Laszlo. It was something to wrap his head around. How she could have so many eyes in the world at once. And Errol Fane on Azarine's floor. That took some getting used to, too. Did they live together? Suhaila had said that it wasn't a marriage anymore, whatever it was between them. As far as he knew, Errol Fane still lived here. "He should come home," he said. "I can sleep on the floor. This is his room, after all." "It isn't a good place for him," she said, staring unseen out the window. Her jaw clenched. Laszlo saw the muscle work. "He's had a lot of nightmares in this room. Many of them were his own, but
I had a hand in plenty.
Laszlo shook his head in wonder.
You know, I thought it was foolish that he was hiding from his nightmares, but he was right. He was hiding from me, even if he didn't know it.
A great wave of weariness broke over Sarai. With a sigh, she closed her eyes and leaned against the window frame. She was as light-headed as she was heavy-limbed. What would she do once the sun rose and she couldn't stay here, in the safety of this dream? She opened her eyes and studied Laszlo. In the real room, a moth took stock of real Laszlo, the relaxation of his face, and his long, easy limbs, loose in slumber. What she wouldn't give for restful sleep like that. Not to mention the degree of control he had within his dreams. She wondered at it.
How did you do that earlier?
She asked him.
The Mahalath, the tea, all of it. How do you shape your dreams with such purpose?
I don't know, he said. It's new to me. I mean, I had some lucidity in dreams before, but not predictability, and never like this, only since you came.
Really?
Sarai was surprised.
I wonder why.
Isn't it like this with other dreamers? She let out a soft laugh.
Laszlo, she said. It isn't anything like this with other dreamers. To start with, they can't even see me.
What do you mean they can't see you?
Just that. It's why I came right up and looked at you that first time, so shamelessly.
She wrinkled her nose, embarrassed.
Because I never imagined you'd be able to see me. With other dreamers, I can scream right in their face, and they'd never know it. Believe me, I've tried. I can do anything at all in a dream except exist.
But why would that be? What a bizarre sort of condition to your gift.
A bizarre condition to a bizarre gift, then. Great Ellen, she's our nurse. She's a ghost. She never saw a gift like mine in all her years in the nursery.
The crease between Laszlo's brows, the new one the Almuthaleth son had made for him, deepened. When Sarai spoke of the nursery and the babies and the gifts, years of them, questions lined up in his mind. More mysteries of weep. How endless was the supply of them? But there was a more personal mystery confronting him now.
But why should I be able to see you if no one else can?
Sarai shrugged, as baffled as he was.
You said they call you Strange the Dreamer. Clearly you're better at dreams than other people.
Oh, clearly, he agreed, self-mocking, and more than a little pleased. Much more than a little, as the idea sank in. All this while, from the moment Sarai appeared at the riverbank and squished her toes into the mud, the entire night had been so extraordinary he'd felt effervescent. But how much more extraordinary was it, now that he knew it was extraordinary for her too? She wasn't quite looking effervescent, though, if he had to be honest with himself. She looked tired.
You're awake now,
he asked. Still trying to grasp how it worked.
Up in the citadel, I mean.
She nodded. Her body was in her alcove. Even in that confined space, it was pacing, like a menagerie rabbit, she thought, with just a whisper of her awareness left behind to guide it. She felt a stab of sympathy for it, abandoned not only by her kin, but by herself, left empty and alone while she was here, weeping her tears onto a stranger's chest.
No, not a stranger. The only one who saw her.
So, when I wake up, he went on, and the city wakes up, you'll just be going to sleep. Sarai experienced the thrum of fear at the thought of falling asleep.
That's the usual practice, she said. But usual is dead and gone.
She took a deep breath and let it out. She told him about Lull,
and how it didn't work anymore, and how, as soon as her consciousness relaxed, it was as though the doors of all her captive terror's cages slid wide open. And, while most people might have a few terrors rattling their cages, she had all of them.
"I did it to myself," she said. "I was so young when I began, and no one ever told me to consider the consequences. Of course, it seems so obvious now."
"But you can't just banish them?" he asked her. "Or transform them?" She shook her head.
"In other people's dreams I have control, but when I'm asleep," she said, "I'm powerless, just like any other dreamer."
She regarded him evenly.
"Except you. You're like no other dreamer."
"Sarai," said Laszlo. He saw how she sagged against the window frame and put out his arm to support her. "How long has it been since you've slept?" She hardly knew.
4 days? I'm not sure."
At his look of alarm, she forced a smile.
"I sleep a little," she said, "in between nightmares."
"But that's mad. You know you can actually die of sleep deprivation." Her answering laugh was grim.
"I didn't know that, no. You don't happen to know how long it takes, do you? So I can plan my day."
She meant it as a joke, but there was an edge of desperation to the question.
"No,"
said Laszlo, feeling spectacularly helpless. What an impossible situation. She was up there alone. He was down here alone. And yet somehow they were together. She was inside his dream, sharing it with him. If he had her gift, he wondered, could he go into her dreams and help her to endure them? What would that mean? What terrors did she face? Fighting off rabbits, witnessing the carnage again and again. Whatever it was, the notion of her facing them alone gutted him. A thought came to him. It seemed to land as lightly as a moth.
"Sarai," he asked, speculative, "what would happen if you were to fall asleep right now?"
Her eyes widened a little.
"What? You mean here?"
She glanced toward the bed.
"No,"
he said quickly, his face going hot. In his head it was clear. He wanted to give her a haven from her nightmares, to be a haven from them.
"I mean, if you keep the moth where it is, on me, but fall asleep up there, could you? Do you think that maybe you could stay here, with me?"
When Sarai was silent, he was afraid the suggestion went too far. Was he not, in a way, inviting her to spend the night with him?
"I only mean," he rushed to explain, "if you're afraid of your own dreams, you're welcome here in mine."
A light frisson of shivers went down Sarai's arms. She wasn't silent because she was offended or dismayed. Quite the opposite. She was overwhelmed. She was welcome. She was wanted. Laszlo didn't know about the nights she'd trespassed without his invitation, tucking a little piece of her mind into a corner of his, so that the wonder and delight of it could help her to endure everything else. She needed rest, badly. And though she joked with him about dying of sleep deprivation, she was, in fact, afraid. The idea that she could stay here, be safe here, with him. It was like a window swinging open, light and air rushing in. But fear, too. Fear of hope. Because the instant she understood what he was proposing, Sarai wanted so badly for it to work. And when did she ever get what she wanted?
"I've never tried it before," she said,
striving to keep her voice neutral. She was afraid of betraying her longing, in case it all should come to nothing.
"Falling asleep might sever the tether," she said, "and cut the moth loose."
"Do you want to try?" asked Laszlo, hopeful, and trying to disguise it. There can't be much time before sunrise.
Not much, he agreed, but a little.
She had another thought. She was poking the idea for weaknesses, and so frightened of finding them. What if it works, but my terrors come too?
Laszlo shrugged.
We'll chase them away, or else turn them into fireflies and catch them in jars.
He wasn't afraid.
Well, he was only afraid it wouldn't work. Anything else they could handle together.
What do you say?
For a moment, Sarai didn't trust her voice. As casual as they strove to seem, they both felt something momentous take shape between them, and, though she didn't for a minute question his intentions, something intimate too. To sleep inside his dream, when she wasn't even certain she'd be aware it was a dream, where she might not have control.
If it does work, she whispered, but I'm powerless.
She faltered, but he understood.
Do you trust me?
He asked. It wasn't even a question. She felt safer here than she ever had anywhere. And anyway, she asked herself, what real risk was there?
It's just a dream, she answered.
Though of course it was so much more. She looked at Laszlo, bit her lip and let it go, and said,
All right.
Chapter 45 Strange Azoth. In the makeshift alchemical laboratory, in the windowless attic of the crematorium, a small blue flame touched the curved glass base of a suspended flask. The liquid there heated and changed state, rising as vapor through the fractionating column to catch in the condenser and trickle in droplets into the collection flask. The golden godson retrieved it and held it up to a glaive to examine it. Clear fluid. It might have been water to look at it, but it wasn't. It was azoth, a substance even more precious than the gold it could yield, because, unlike gold, it had multiple, wondrous applications, and but a single source in all the world. Himself. At least as long as its key component remained secret. A vial lay empty on the work table. It was labeled Spirit of Librarian, and Thion felt a twinge of distaste. Here was vital essence of the no-name peasant foundling, who had the unforgivable habit of helping him for no good reason, all while looking guileless, as though it were a normal thing to do. Maybe it was distaste. Thion pushed the empty vial aside to clear space for his next procedure. Or maybe it was discomfort. The whole world saw him the way he wanted to be seen, as an unassailable force, complete unto himself and in full command of the mysteries of the universe. Except for Strange, that is, who knew what he really was. His jaw clenched. If only, he thought, Laszlo would have the courtesy to cease to exist. Then perhaps he could be grateful to him. But not while he was there. Always there. A benign presence laughing with warriors, or doing gladly whatever needed to be done. He'd even formed the habit of helping the caravan's cook scrub the big soup pot out with sand. What was he trying to prove? Thion shook his head. He knew the answer. He just couldn't understand it. Laszlo wasn't trying to prove anything. Nothing was strategy with him. Nothing was deception. Strange was just Strange, and he'd offered up his spirit with no strings attached. Thion was grateful, even if he was resentful in equal or greater measure. He had drawn too much of his own spirit, and that was a dangerous game. Laszlo's jibe that it would make him ugly had not missed its mark. But that wasn't his only concern. He had seen the spirit dead. Most didn't last long, either taking their own lives or wasting away from a lack of will even to eat. The will to live, it would seem, existed in this mysterious clear fluid,
that Strange had given of without a second thought. And Thion was much restored, thanks to the reprieve. He was taking another stab at Alcahest, using the Strange Azoth this time. Usually he felt a stir of eagerness at this part of a chemical procedure, a thrill to create something no one else could, and alter the very structure of nature. Alcahest was a universal solvent, true to its name, and had never failed him before. He'd tested it tirelessly back at the Chrysoposium, and it had dissolved every substance he'd touched it to, even diamond. But not Mesarthium. The damnable metal frightened him in its unnaturalness, and he felt already the ignominy of defeat. But scientific method was Thion's religion, and it dictated the repeat of experiments, even of failures. So he cooked a new batch of chemicals, and took the Alcahest over to the North Anchor to test it again. It wasn't in its final preparation, of course, or else it would eat through its container. He would make the final mixture at the last moment to activate it. And then, when nothing happened, as nothing would, he would apply the neutralizing compound to deactivate it, so it didn't just drip down the impervious metal and eat its way into the ground. He was going to take a nap after. That was what he was thinking about. Beauty sleep, you strange bastard. As he walked through the moonless city of Weep, with a satchel of flasks slung over his shoulder, he was going to repeat his experiment and record its failure, and then he was going to bed. There wasn't even a moment, not even a second, in which Thion Nero considered that the experiment might not fail. Chapter 46. Just a Dream. Sarai called the rest of her moths home early, leaving just the one on Laszlo's brow. She hesitated only to recall the one watching over her father. Watching him, she corrected herself. Not watching over him. That wasn't what she was doing. Here she'd finally found him, and she couldn't even look into his mind. It was a relief, she admitted to herself, finally giving up and drawing the moth off the wall and out the window, back up into the air. She was afraid to know what she would find in his dreams, now that he knew she was alive. Could it be that after everything there was still some capacity for hope in her, that he might be glad she wasn't dead? She shook it off. Of course he wouldn't be glad. But tonight she didn't have to know it. She left him to his thoughts, whatever they might be. The journey from rooftops to terrace was long for such small fluttering scraps as moths, and she had never been so impatient as in those minutes while they rose through the heights of the air. When they finally arrived and fluttered back through the terrace door, she saw the ghost standing guard, and remembered with a start that she was a prisoner. She'd all but forgotten, and didn't dwell on it now. Most of her awareness was with Laszlo. She was still in his room with him, when, up in her own, she parted her lips to receive her moth's home. She turned away from him in the dream, even though she knew he couldn't see her real mouth or the moth's vanishing into it. Their wings brushed over her lips, soft as the ghost of a kiss, and all she could think was how the sight would disgust him. Who would ever want to kiss a girl who eats moths? I don't eat them, she argued with herself. Your lips still taste of salt and soot. Stop thinking of kissing. And then, the unusual experience of lying down on her bed in full dark, her real body in her real bed, in the stillness of knowing both Citadel and City were sleeping, and with the thread of her consciousness still stretched down into Weep. It had been years since she'd gone to bed before sunrise. As Laszlo had earlier lain stiffly, his very eagerness for sleep keeping sleep at bay, so did Sarai, a heightened awareness of her limbs giving rise to brief doubts as to how she arranged them when she wasn't thinking about it. She achieved something like her natural sleep position, curled on her side, her hands tucked under one cheek. Her weary body and wearier mind which had seemed, in her exhaustion, to be drifting away from each other like untethered boats, made some peace with the tides. Her hearts were beating too fast for sleep, though. Not with dread, but agitation, lest it shouldn't work, and excitement, as wild and soft as a chaos of moth wings, lest it should. In the room down in the city, she stood by the window a while and talked with Laszlo in a newly shy way, and that sense of the momentous did not die down. Sarai thought of Ruby's envious laments about how she got to live. It had never felt true before, but now it did. Was it living, if it was a dream? Just a dream, she was reminded. But the words had little meaning when the knots of the hand-tied rug under her imaginary feet were more vivid than the smooth silk pillow beneath her actual cheek. When the company of this dreamer made her feel awake for the first time, even as she tried to sleep. She was unsettled, standing there with him. Her mind was unquiet.
I wonder if it might be easier to fall asleep, she ventured finally, if I'm not talking.
Of course, he said. Do you want to lie down? He blushed at his own suggestion. She did too. Please be comfortable, he said. Can I get you anything?
No, thank you, said Sarai.
And with a funny feeling of repeating herself, she lay down on the bed, here, much as she had up above. She stayed close to the edge. It wasn't a large bed. She didn't think he would lie down too, but she left room enough in case he did. He stayed by the window, and she saw him make as though to put his hands in his pockets, only to discover that his breeches didn't have pockets. He looked awkward for a moment before remembering this was a dream. Then pockets appeared, and his hands went in. Sarai folded hers once more under her cheek. This bed was more comfortable than her own. The whole room was. She liked the stone walls and wood beams that had been shaped by human hands and tools instead of by the mind of Scathis. It was snug, but that was nice too. It was cozy. Nothing in the citadel was cozy. Not even her alcove behind the dressing room, though that came closest. It struck her with fresh force that this was her father's bed, as the bed in the alcove had been his before it was hers. How many times had she imagined him lying awake there, plotting murder and revolt? Now, as she lay here, she thought of him as a boy, dreading being stolen and spirited up to the citadel. Had he dreamed of being a hero, she wondered. And if he had, what had he imagined it would be like? Nothing like it was, she was sure. Nothing like a ruined temple that only ghosts could enter. And then, well, it wasn't sudden, exactly. Rather, Sarai became aware that something was softly different, and she understood what it was. She was no longer in multiple places, but just one. She had misplaced her awareness of her true body reposed in her true bed, and of the moth on Laszlo's brow. She was only here, and it felt all the more real for it. Oh! She sat up, the full realization hitting her. She was here. It had worked. The moth's tether had not snapped. She was asleep. Oh, blessed rest. And instead of her own unconscious, fraught with prowling terrors, she was safe in Laszlo's. She laughed, a little incredulous, a little nervous, a little pleased. Okay, a lot pleased. Well, a lot nervous, too. A lot everything. She was asleep in Laszlo's dream. He watched her, expectant. The sight of her there, her blue legs bare to the knees, entangled in his rumpled blankets, and her hair mussed from his pillow, made for an aching sweet vision. He was highly conscious of his hands, and it wasn't from the awkwardness of not knowing what to do with them, but from knowing rather what he wished to do with them. It tingled along his palms, the aching urge to touch her, His hands felt wide awake.
Well?
He asked, anxious.
Did it work?
She nodded, breaking into a wide, wondering smile that he could hardly help but mirror back at her. What a long, extraordinary night it had been. How many hours had passed since he had closed his eyes, hoping she would come? And now, in some way he couldn't entirely wrap his mind around, she was. Well, that was it, wasn't it? He had entirely wrapped his mind around her. He held a goddess in his mind as one might cup a butterfly in one's hands, keeping it safe just long enough to set it free. Free. Could it be possible? Could she ever be free? Yes. Yes. Somehow.
Well then,
he said, feeling a scope of possibility as immense as oceans.
Now that you're here, what shall we do?
It was a good question. With the infinite possibilities of dreaming, it wasn't easy to narrow it down.
We could go anywhere, said Laszlo. The sea? We could sail a leviathan and set it free. The Amphion fields of Thanagost. Warlords and leashed wolves and drifting Ulola blossoms like fleets of living bubbles. Or the Cloudspire. We might climb it and steal emeralds from the eyes of the sarcophagi, like Calixte. Do you fancy becoming a jewel thief, my lady?
Sarai's eyes sparkled.
It does sound fun, she said.
It all sounded marvelous.
But you've only mentioned real places and things so far. Do you know what I'd like?
She was sitting on her knees on the bed, her shoulders straight and hands clasped in her lap. Her smile was a brilliant specimen, and she wore the moon on her wrist. Laszlo was plain dazzled by the sight of her.
What?
He asked.
Anything, he thought. I'd like for the Wingsmiths to come to town.
The Wingsmiths, he repeated. And somewhere within him, as though with a whir of gears and a ping of sprung locks, a previously unsuspected vault of delight spilled open.
Like you mentioned the other day,
said Sarai, girlish in her demure posture and childlike excitement.
I'd like to buy some wings and test them out. And after that, perhaps we might try riding dragons and see which is more fun.
Laszlo had to laugh. The delight filled him up. He thought he'd never laughed like this before, from this new place in him, where so much delight had been waiting in reserve.
You've just described my perfect day, he said.
And he held out his hand, and she took it. She rose to her knees and slid off the side of the bed. But at the moment that her feet touched the floor, a great concussion thumed in the street. A tremor shook the room. Plaster rained from the ceiling, and all the excitement was stricken from Sarai's face.
Oh, gods,
she said, in a rasp of a whisper.
It's happening.
What is? What's happening?
The terrors, my nightmares, they're here.
Chapter 47 The Terrors.
Show me,
said Laszlo, who still wasn't afraid. As he'd said before, if her terror spilled over, they'd take care of it. But Sarai shook her head, wild.
No, not this. Close the shutters. Hurry!
But what is it? He asked. He moved toward the window, not to close the shutters, but to look out. But before he could, they slammed before him with a crack and rattle, and the latch fell securely into place. Eyebrows raised, he turned to Sarai.
Well, it seems you're not powerless here after all.
When she just looked at him blankly, he pointed to the shutters and said,
You did that, not me. I did?
She asked. He nodded. She stood up a little straighter, but she had no time to gather her courage, because outside the thoom came again. lower now and with subtler tremors, and then again and again in rhythmic repetition. Thoom, thoom, thoom. Sarai backed away from the window.
He's coming,
she said, shaking. Laszlo followed her. He reached for her shoulders and held them gently.
It's all right, he said. Remember, Sarai, it's just a dream.
She couldn't feel the truth of his words. All she felt was the approach, the closing in, the dread. The dread that was as pure a distillation of fear as any emotion Isagol had ever made. Sarai's hearts were wild with it, and with anguish too. How could she have deployed this again and again into the dreams of the helpless sleepers of Weep? What kind of monster was she? It had been her most powerful weapon, because it was their most potent fear. And now it was stalking her.
Thoom, thoom, thoom.
Great, relentless footsteps, closer, louder.
Who is it?
Laszlo asked, still holding Sarai's shoulders. Her panic, he found, was catching. It seemed to pass from her skin to his, moving up from his hands, up his arms in coursing vibrations of fear.
Who's coming?
Shh, she said, her eyes so wide they showed a full ring of white. And when she whispered, it was breath shaped into words and made no sound at all.
He'll hear you.
Thoom. Sarai froze. It didn't seem possible for her eyes to widen any further, but they did. And in that brief moment of silence when the footsteps ceased, that terrible pause that every household in Weep had dreaded for 200 years, Sarai's panic overpowered Laszlo's reason, so that they were both in it, living it, when the shutters, without warning, were ripped from their hinges in a havoc of splintering wood and shattered glass. And there, just outside, was the creature whose footsteps shook the bones of Weep. It was no living thing, but moved as though it were, as sinuous as a rabbit, and shining like poured mercury. It was all Mazarthium, smooth, bunched muscle shaped for crouching and leaping. The flanks of a great cat, the neck and heavy hump of a bull, wings as sharp and vicious as the wings of the great seraph, though on a smaller scale. And a head that was made for nightmares. Its head was carrion. It was metal, of course, but like the relief on the walls of Sarai's rooms, the songbirds and lilies so real they mocked the master carvers of Weep, it was utterly true to life. Or rather, true to death. It was a dead thing, a rotten thing, a skull with the flesh peeling off, revealing teeth to the roots in a grimace of fangs, and in the great black eye sockets were no eyes, but only a terrible, all-seeing light. It had horns thick as arms, tapering to wicked points, and it pawed at the ground and tossed its head, a roar rumbling up its metal throat. It was Rasselas, the beast of the North Anchor, and it wasn't the true monster. The true monster was astride it. Scathis, god of beasts, master of metal, thief of sons and daughters, tormentor of Weep. Laszlo had only the crudely drawn mural to go on, but he beheld now the god who had stolen so much. Not just sons and daughters, though that was the dark heart of it. Scathis had stolen the sky from the city, and the city from the world. What tremendous, insidious power that took. And here was the god himself. One might expect a presence to rival the godslayers, a dark counterpart to his light, as two Quell kings faced off across a game board. But no, he was nothing next to the godslayer. Here was no dark majesty, no fell magnificence. He was of ordinary stature, and his face was just a face. He was no demon god from myth. But for his color, that extraordinary blue, there was nothing extraordinary about him, besides the cruelty in his face. He was neither handsome nor ugly, distinguished only by the malice that burned in his grey eyes, and that serpent smile of cunning and venom. But he rode upon Rasselas, and that more than made up for any shortfall of godly grandeur, the beast an extension of his own psyche, every prowling, pawing step and toss of the head his own. Each growl that echoed up that metal throat was his as surely as if issued from his own flesh throat. His hair was of sullen brown, and he wore on it a crown of Mazathium shaped as a wreath of serpents swallowing each other by the tails. They moved about his brow in sinuous waves of devouring, round and round, relentless. He was clothed in a coat of velvet and diamond dust, with long, fluttering tails in the shape of knife blades, and his boots were white spectral leather, buckled with lis. It was an accursed thing to flay a spectral and wear its skin. Those boots might almost have been of human leather, so deeply wrong were they. But none of the terrible details could account for the purity of dread that surged through the room. Through the dream. Though both Laszlo and Sarai had lost their grip on that fact, and were prey to the torrents of the unconscious. That pure dread, as Laszlo had witnessed again and again since arriving in Weep, was a collective horror that had been building for 2 full centuries. How many young men and women had been taken up in all that time, and returned with no memories after this moment? This moment at their door or window, when the leering god came calling. Laszlo thought of Suhaila, and Azarine, and Errol Fane, and so many others, taken just like this, no matter what their families did to keep them safe. Again the question beat at his mind. Why? All the stolen girls and boys, their memories taken, and much more than that. The nursery, the babies. Why? On the one hand, it was obvious, and certainly nothing new. If there has ever been a conqueror who did not exact this most devastating tithe from his subjects, he is unknown to history. The youth are the spoils of war, chattel, labor. No one is safe. Tyrants have always taken who they wanted, and tyrants always will. The king of Syriza had a harem even now. But this stood apart. There was something systematic in the taking, something shrouded. That was what nudged at Laszlo's mind, but briefly, only to be churned under by the overwhelming dread. Just a few minutes earlier he had thought, nonchalant, that he could catch Sarai's terrors like fireflies in a jar. Now the enormity of them reached out to catch him.
"Strange the dreamer,"
said Scathis, extending one imperious hand.
"Come with me."
"No,"
cried Sarai. She grabbed at Laszlo's arm and clutched it to herself. Scathis grinned.
"Come now. You know there is no safety and no salvation. There is only surrender."
Only surrender. Only surrender. What flooded Sarai was the emotion of everyone ever left behind. Every family member or fiancé, childhood sweetheart or best friend, who could do nothing but surrender as their loved one was taken up. Rasselas reared up on its hind legs, its huge clawed paws coming down hard on the window ledge, crumbling it away. Sarai and Laszlo stumbled backward. They clung together.
"You can't have him,"
choked Sarai.
"Don't worry, child," said Scathis, fixing her with his cold eyes. "I'm taking him for you."
She shook her head, hard, at the idea that this thing should be done in her name. As Isagol had taken Errol Fane for her own, so would Scathis take Laszlo for her. But then, that very idea, the paradox of it, of Scathis taking Laszlo from her to bring him to her, split Sarai back into 2 people, the one in the citadel and the one in this room. and uncovered the border between dream and reality that had become lost in the fear. This was just a dream, and as long as she knew that, she wouldn't be powerless in it. All the fear washed away like dust in a rainstorm.
"You are the muse of nightmares,"
Sarai told herself.
"You are their mistress, not their thrall."
And she threw up one hand, not forming in her mind a precise attack, but, as with the Mahalath, letting some deeper voice within herself decide. It decided, apparently, that Scathis was already dead. Before Sarai's and Laszlo's eyes, the god jerked, eyes widening in shock as a Hereshtek suddenly burst out through his chest. His blood was red as the paint in the mural, in which, it occurred to Laszlo, Scathis was depicted just like this. Stabbed from behind, the sword slitting out right between his hearts. A red bubble appeared at his lips, and very quickly he was dead. Very quickly. This was no natural depiction of his death, but a clear reminder of it.
"You're dead. Stay dead. Leave us alone."
Rasalas, the beast, froze in place, all Mazarthium dying with its master. While on its back, the Lord of the Mazarthium collapsed in on himself, withering, deflating, until nothing remained but a bloodless, spiritless husk of blue flesh to be carried off, with a terrific screech, in a flash of melting white, by the great bird Wraith, appearing from nowhere and vanishing the same way. The room was quiet, but for quick breathing. The nightmare was over, and Laszlo and Sarai clung together, staring into the face of Rasalas, frozen in a snarl. Its great feet were still up on the window ledge, claws sunk into the stone. Laszlo reached out a shaking arm and yanked the curtain closed. The other arm he left in Sarai's possession. She was still clinging to it, both of her own arms wrapped around it, as though she meant to dig in her heels and wrestle Scathis for him. She'd done better than that. She had vanquished the god of beasts. Laszlo was sure he had done none of it.
"Thank you," he said, turning to her. They were so very near already,
her body pressed against his arm. His turning brought them nearer, face to face, his tilted down, hers up, so that the space between them was hardly more than the wisp of tea steam that, earlier in the night, had drifted up between them at the riverbank tea table. It was new to both of them, this nearness that mingles breath and warmth, and they shared the sensation that they were absorbing each other, melting together in an exquisite crucible. It was an intimacy both had imagined, but never, they now knew, successfully. The truth was so much better than the fantasy. The wild, soft wings were in a frenzy. Sarai couldn't think. She wanted only to keep on melting. But there was something in the way. She was still blinking away the afterimage of Rasalas's gleaming teeth, and the knowledge that it was all her fault.
"Don't thank me," she said,
letting go of Laszlo's arm and looking down, breaking the gaze.
"I brought that here. You should throw me out. You don't want me in your mind, Laszlo. I'll just ruin it."
"You ruin nothing," he said, and his wood-smoke voice had never been sweeter.
"I might be asleep, but this has still been the best night of my life."
Marveling, he gazed at her eyes, her cinnamon brows, the perfect curve of her blue cheek, and that luscious lip with the crease in the center, sweet as a slice of ripe fruit. He dragged his eyes up from it, back to hers.
"Sarai," he said,
and if Ravid's purred, it might sound something like the way he said her name.
"You must see. I want you in my mind."
And he wanted her in his arms. He wanted her in his life. He wanted her not trapped in the sky, not hunted by humans, not hopeless, and not besieged by nightmares whenever she closed her eyes. He wanted to bring her to a real riverbank, and let her sink her toes into the mud. He wanted to curl up with her in a real library and smell the books and open them and read them to each other. He wanted to buy them both wings from the wingsmiths so that they could fly away with a stash of blood candy in a little treasure chest so that they could live forever. He'd learned, the moment he glimpsed what lay beyond the cusp, that the realm of the unknowable was so much bigger than he'd guessed. He wanted to discover how much bigger, with her. But first, he just really, really, really wanted to kiss her. He searched her eyes for acquiescence and found it. Freely she gave it. It was like a thread of light passing from one to the other, and it was more than acquiescence. It was complicity and desire. Her breathing shallowed. She stepped in, closing that little space. There was a limit to their melting, and they found it and defied it. His chest was hard against hers. Hers was soft against his. His hands closed on her waist. Her arms came round his neck. The walls gave forth a shimmer like sunrise on fierce water. Countless tiny stars spent themselves in radiance, and neither Sarai nor Laszlo knew which of them was making it. Perhaps they both were, and there was such brilliance in the endless, careless diamonds of light. But there was awareness, too, and urgency. Under the skin of dreaming, they both knew that dawn was near, and that their embrace could not survive it. So Sarai rose to her toes, erasing the last little gap between their flushed faces. Their lashes fluttered shut, honey red and river cat, and their mouths, soft and hungry, found each other, and had just time to touch and press and sweetly, sweetly open before the first wan morning light seeped in at the window, touched the dusky wing of the moth on Laszlo's brow, and, in a puff of indigo smoke, annihilated it. Chapter 48. No Place in the World. Sarai vanished from Laszlo's arms, and Laszlo vanished from Sarai's. The shared dream ripped right down the middle and spilled them both out. Sarai woke in her bed in the citadel with the warmth of his lips still on hers, and Laszlo woke in the city, a moth-shaped puff of smoke diffusing on his brow. They sat up at the same moment, and for both, the sudden absence was the powerful inverse of the presence they'd felt just an instant before. Not mere physical presence, the heat of a body against one's own, though that too, but something more profound. This was not the frustration one feels at waking from a sweet dream. It was the desolation of having found the place that fits, the one true place, and experiencing the first heady sigh of rightness before being torn away and cast back into random, lonely scatter. The place was each other, and the irony was sharp, since they couldn't be in the same place, and had come no closer to each other in physical reality than her screaming at him across her terrace while ghosts clawed and tore at her. But even knowing that was true, that they hadn't been in the same place all this long night through, but practically on different planes of existence, him on the ground, her in the sky, Sarai could not accept that they hadn't been together. She collapsed back on her bed, and her fingers reached wonderingly to trace her own lips, where a moment before his had been. Not really, perhaps, but truly. That is to say, they might not have really kissed, but they had truly kissed. Everything about this night was true in a way that transcended their bodies. But that didn't mean their bodies wanted to be transcended. The ache. Laszlo fell back on his pillows, too, raised fists to his eyes and pressed. Breath hissed out between his clenched teeth. To have been granted so tiny a taste of the nectar of her mouth and so brief a brush with the velvet of her lips was unspeakable cruelty. He felt set on fire. He had to convince himself that liberating a silk sleigh and flying forthwith to the citadel was not a viable option. That would be like the prince.